It is 8:09 in the Twin Cities. We're at 49 degrees. Time now to chat with Professor Stephen Scheer of Carleton College, talking politics. How are you, Professor Scheer?
I am well, thank you.
All right. Well, listen, let's get right into it. The big development in the presidential race certainly is finally Joe Biden got into the race. Your thoughts about his candidacy? He still is on top when you look at all these polls, whether it's by state, nationally. He's either tied with the top in front or else right there with Bernie Sanders.
Right.
Your thoughts about him finally getting in, and what are his challenges right now?
Well, there are essentially two theories about Biden. I'll give you both of them. The negative theory about Biden is that he has support, but it's shallow and could easily shift based on momentum for another candidate. That he's basically leading because of name identification and not necessarily because he's a magnetic candidate. So that's a negative argument. The positive argument is that he's got 20 opponents. And how does anybody emerge from a field of 20 opponents to defeat the front runner, particularly when he's going to be well-funded and is better known than most of the other people in the field? So, you can argue it either way, Esme.
Right. And I think though, it's interesting, and I agree with you. Those are the two differing views of Joe Biden. I do think, though, that Joe Biden, yes, he's been out there for a while. I do think that people came to sort of embrace him as the vice president. He is a known entity. And I wonder, though, if one of his problems is that even people who think they know Joe Biden and think they really like Joe Biden are going to find out about a past Joe Biden that they weren't aware of.
Well, here's what's really interesting about Biden is that he has had 46 years in national office before running for president. Now, no presidential candidate in American history has had such a long record in national office before running for office. The previous record holder was Martin Van Buren, who was in national office for 31 years.
Wow. So that's that really is a testament to how, he was very young. He was in his 20s when he was elected to the Senate.
Elected to the Senate in 1972.
Which was a long time ago.
Yes, very much so. So there's a big record there, and I suppose a lot of his opponents for the nomination view that as a target-rich environment. But the question is, how much will people care about Joe Biden's positions 30 years ago or 20 years ago? That will, I think, have a lot to do with how well Biden does running for the nomination this time.
Right. And one of the things that's come out because of the long track record, and when you think about it, being elected in 1972, that was a very different era in goodness knows so many ways. It's impossible to understand that.
Yeah.
But one of the things I thought that was fascinating that came out is that Joe Biden actually called Anita Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And for people of a certain age, for women of a certain age, including myself, that was just a galvanizing moment. And it was Joe Biden was the chair of the Judiciary Committee, and he was not particularly receptive or helpful to Anita Hill. And
right.
And I think what he was hoping to get when he called her privately a number of weeks ago was maybe her blessing. He apologized to her. Well, he apologized in a way to her.
Mm-hmm.
And expressed regret to her, but she didn't give him a full apology. She didn't give him a clean slate. Is that ancient history that is going to get buried here? Does it really matter still, or is that one of the big questions?
That is one of the big questions. I think there is a group of more left-oriented Democratic activists for whom this is a major problem. The question is, how many are there? And they'll certainly be numerous in caucus states, but whether they'll be a big part of primary state electorates is not at all clear. And another thing to note, Esme, is that the number of caucus states in the nomination process has gone down. It's now about 15. It used to be about 20. So that will matter less, I think, in the ultimate outcome.
Right. And when you talk about the number of caucus states going down, we're one of them who's losing
right.
the caucus, which which is, I think, going to be great. Just on a side note here, I just happen to think that that's a good thing. I actually was at in St. Paul at the caucus at a caucus in St. Paul in 2016, and it was so crowded, almost overwhelmingly, and again, this is St. Paul, with Bernie Sanders supporters. It was so crowded. And obviously, you know, people can't, unlike voting, where you can space it out or you can do it in advance or days in advance, you've all got to come at the same time. People actually fainted in the rooms. I mean, it was just, it was really out of control. And people who were, you know, I looked at it and I said, this is just not a good system for people who are have trouble getting around or people who have children. I mean, people were trying to juggle young children there. And I thought, this just isn't right.
The logistics were all wrong. It's not a system designed for heavy popular participation.
Right.
It cannot accommodate that. And
right.
that's why it's gone.
Right. And it just was not, you know, for those people who had, you know, who are older or who might not be well or who had children, it just was not a good system. As I said, people were literally fainting in some of those rooms at the St. Paul School. And the folks running it were doing the best they could. But it was just there were too many people there. There were too many people who wanted to take part. But I did get sidetracked there. But so there are fewer caucuses this time around. I mean, do you think that helps Joe Biden?
Yeah, I do, because I think that he will get he will do particularly well with Democrats who are not carrying heavy issue agendas into their activism, and that really includes a larger number of people, a bigger percentage of people in a primary electorate as opposed to those who show up at precinct caucuses. People who show up at precinct caucuses are willing to spend 4 hours in the middle of the winter pursuing their agendas. And that's usually a small group of people who are deeply committed. And those, as you said, are Bernie Sanders supporters, people who I think probably have strong left-oriented principles in the Democratic Party. That's not the base for Joe Biden. He has to appeal more to, I guess, less motivated, more moderate Democrats. And those are the people who are more likely to show up at a primary, not at a caucus.
All right. Listen, we are chatting with Professor Stephen Scheer. We're talking about Joe Biden's entry into the race. We do have to take a quick break. I want to ask Professor Stephen Scheer, one of the things that happened this week after former Vice President Joe Biden enters the race, he gets called out by the president for being too old. So let's get we'll get your reaction and your take on that. You're listening to News Talk 830 WCCO. It is 48 degrees in the Twin Cities, 819 here at News Talk 830. Esme Murphy chatting with Professor Stephen Scheer. I want to ask you about the president calling out Joe Biden, saying, you know, basically the president saying, hey, listen, I am young and strong and vibrant, and he's an old guy.
Yeah.
I love that. I thought that was remarkable. Of course, the president, not that the vice president, Joe Biden, is 76.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Trump is 72, and he's going to be 73, I think, in June.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts about this?
Well, he's already come up with a name for Joe Biden. You know,
right, of course he has.
Hillary, it's Sleepy Joe Biden, who is not going to be up for the job. Esme, if Joe Biden is the Democratic nominee in 2020, this will be the first time in American history you will have a choice between two major party nominees who are in their 70s. This has never happened before. So that would be remarkable. I think that, you know, if you're going to raise that issue against Joe Biden, it helps if you're not 73.
Well, that's what I was. I agree with you completely, and I think the fact that the president is 73, and the president, I mean, while he appears very healthy, I think he looks very much the same as he did when he took office.
Right.
He's obviously he's sort of. He has released medical reports, but He released one report from a doctor who said he was the healthiest president in the history of the United States, which is obviously...
I'm sorry, I had trouble with that one.
Yeah, how could he possibly have know how healthy everybody else was? But I do think I agree with you. I do think that helps Joe Biden. And I think Joe Biden obviously is a few years older. He does appear healthier. He's, not overweight, whereas the president appears to be a little on that side.
Right. And it does look as if Joe Biden has had some plastic surgery done to sort of nip and tuck here and there. On the other hand, his hair does seem to be a natural color. So
right. Although I think he definitely has had the hair plugs. I don't think there's any question about that.
That happened back in the late 1970s. He had a hair transplant.
Right.
He would be bald as a billiard ball otherwise.
Right. I do think that helps a lot.
Yeah.
And I do think it counters that. And then also, one of the things that's come up with Joe Biden too recently is you have had a number of women say that he touched them inappropriately.
Right.
When he met them or he kissed their head, stuff that I just can't imagine somebody who I don't know doing to me. You just don't act that way, but Joe Biden apparently does. It's Al Franken resigned for something awfully similar.
But, also some male reporters have said he grabs them, too. He said
he's
a very touchy fellow.
And does he kiss them on their hair?
Well, that I don't know.
But in a way, I do think that Vice President Biden did come out and sort of address it and said, I've learned or whatever. And I think given that the president has had this kind of allegation made against him, not much worse, I think it seems like a wash.
Right. The one thing with Biden you have to worry about, though, is that he is sometimes not verbally very disciplined. He ran for president twice before, in 1988 and in 2008. And in 1988, he had to drop out because he had frequently used a speech that essentially was copied from a British politician, Neil Kinnock, without attribution.
Right.
And then in 2008, he was running against Obama and Hillary and did not make much of an impression then. So he's 0-2 so far. The question is whether, he has learned from that and will be a more disciplined and effective candidate.
Right. So he is 0-2, and I think people forget that he was in that race. Remember 2008, it was wide open, but Joe Biden was in there running, and it didn't work out. Obviously, he's at the top of the polls, right now, or most of the polls. Historically, have people who've been at the top, like around now, been the nominee? And let's face it, the convention is, it's a little over a year away, 14 months away.
Right. Well, that tends to be the case, but I think you also have to keep in mind, you have to look at, first of all, the absolute level of support that the front runner has, and then the margin between the front runner and the other candidates. And he's basically under 30%, so he's still got a ways to go. And Bernie Sanders is nipping at his heels, and there are several other candidates who could surprise and develop momentum very quickly. Biden faces an immediate problem with the Iowa caucuses. Caucuses don't favor someone who's a more moderate Democrat. And the New Hampshire primary, where already the polls show Bernie Sanders is well ahead. So if he starts out by losing Iowa and New Hampshire and then goes to South Carolina, who knows
how
the race stands at that point.
Right. And that's an interesting point about Iowa and that bounce, although I think people might say, look at New Hampshire and say, Bernie Sanders is just the senator next door.
He's there.
So that could be a disqualifier, too. The other thing is that you don't know which candidate is going to surge. I mean, it doesn't, what are your thoughts about how Senator Klobuchar is doing?
Well, I think Biden's announcement is not good for Amy Klobuchar's presidential campaign, but is good for her vice presidential campaign. in that she would, I think, be a very attractive vice presidential nominee, a woman, someone with a similar issue profile who could appeal to political independence in a way that Biden does.
Right,
right now, Amy Klobuchar is at about 1% in the national polls in a 21-candidate field. That's tough.
It's very tough.
Yeah.
And Steve, I do want to let you know, like at 8:31, we are going to take an update from CBS News on that fatal shooting at a synagogue in California earlier today. But I do want to ask you about the fact, I did think it was sort of brilliant of Biden to put his headquarters, not in Delaware, where he's from, you know, when most people have it, you know, where they're from, but in Pennsylvania, where he was actually born and grew up.
Right.
And saying, you got to win Pennsylvania. And you do have to win Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah.
And Donald Trump won Pennsylvania. I thought that was a very good move.
Yeah. And that's, I think, one of the arguments for Biden's electability, that he can perhaps more than any other candidate in the field have a serious chance of carrying Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, the three states that delivered the presidency to Donald Trump in the Electoral College. And I actually think, if you look at the Democratic field, that in a general election, Biden would be a very formidable opponent to President Trump.
Right. And that's something that has come up as well. But I do think, and we were talking about that earlier, just, you know, the fact that it was Wisconsin, those slim, slim majorities in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, states that are traditionally won by Democrats, that went for Donald Trump. And of course, infamously, Hillary Clinton never even campaigned in Wisconsin. I don't think the president is actually, President Trump is actually holding a rally in Wisconsin tonight as we speak, in Green Bay. I don't think that's going to happen again to Wisconsin. I think Wisconsin, because we've got a lot of listeners in Wisconsin, I think Wisconsin, you're going to feel the love this time around.
Right, but you know, also, I'm surprised to see that Minnesota's going to feel the love, too, that the Trump people see a caring Minnesota as a real possibility. Now, I don't know that they have looked very carefully at the 2018 results in Minnesota, but we will get a lot of attention.
Right. Well, he came pretty close.
Yeah.
It was 50,000 votes. I mean, it was one of the last states that was called.
Right. Hillary carried the state by only about 1.6%, but in 2018, you really did have a sizable blue wave in this state. You have to wonder if Trump can overcome that in 2020. It's not clear to me he can.
Right. And Minnesotans traditionally do, you know, split their vote and separate their vote. But you know, you raise a very good point. But it was certainly much, much closer. And I do think the president, every time he comes here, and he was here just a couple weeks ago, you know, says, hey, I one more visit, I could have won. And he might be right.
Right, right. He's certainly going to test that theory in 2020, and we're going to find out. So, you know, he'll be campaigning a lot in Wisconsin and Minnesota in 2020, as will Joe Biden. So we will not be flyover country.
Right.
Not at all.
And you know, the Trump people said that last-minute visit that they made to Minnesota 2 days before the election, he actually campaigned at the airport, was designed to bleed into the Wisconsin media market, because our market here, we've got a lot of Wisconsin viewers, and that's what he did. And he did pick up, obviously, Wisconsin, nearly picked up Minnesota. It's 8:36 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock, chatting with Professor Stephen Scheer of Carleton College. Well, let's shift gears here and talk about the scene at the state capitol in St. Paul. May 20th is that deadline that's set in the state constitution for arriving at a budget and overall agreement for state government. And I just don't see how that's going to happen. What are your thoughts?
Well, you do hear vaguely optimistic sentiments from both Paul Gazelka, the Republican leader of the state Senate, Melissa Hortman, the Democratic leader of the state House, and Democratic Governor Tim Walz. But the agenda differences are really very large because the Walz proposals are really a very ambitious increase in state spending and Republicans do not want to raise those revenues, and they want spending to be significantly lower in rate of increase than President or than Governor Walz wants. So how do we get from here to there? It's not at all clear how we do that, and we've only got about 3 weeks to do it.
Right. And that's and you know, these bills are enormous and they've got to get it done by May 20th. If they don't, they can go into a special session. But if they don't, and I think that the system of government we have here in Minnesota, I think it's very confusing for a lot of people that there are some years where if they don't reach an agreement, it's OK. But every other year, you got to reach an agreement. And if
right.
you don't, there could be a government shutdown. Folks, this is one of the years they've got to reach an agreement.
Right. It's a biennial budget. It'll be around $50 billion.
Right.
So it's going to be, you know, it goes up steadily because of increases in many of which are automatic in the programs. But 42% of the state budget is health care, 18% is education. So there you're almost at two-thirds. And there are big differences in the education bills between the state House and the state Senate, and also big differences on health care policy. Do we keep the 2% healthcare provider tax? The Republicans in the Senate say no. Democrats in the House and the governor say yes. There are so many differences. It's hard to see how you really get to an agreement. The other thing to keep in mind, I think this is particularly the case in the Republican Senate, is that Republican senators have to run for renomination, and voting in favor of tax increases is very difficult for an incumbent trying to be renominated in the Republican Party in Minnesota. And that, I think, is a real impediment to any sort of agreement with Democrats who do want a series of tax increases.
So you mean they've got to run for renomination soon?
Yeah.
Right.
In 2020, because the entire state Senate is up in
right.
2020. So there are electoral consequences for budget decisions now for Republican senators.
Right. So in 2018, when the House flipped, the Minnesota House flipped from, it was in Republican control, it flipped to Democratic control, the entire House was up.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw this flipping here.
Yes.
But none of the Senate was up. And
right.
What's not clear is, you know, I think, you know, Democrats like to say, well, if they had been up, they would have lost, but they weren't up. but that is something that they are up. So that when does the nomination process or the party process starts getting underway pretty soon, right?
It does. It will occur in the summer of 2020, but and a lot of decisions will be made about who runs for a re-election, who decides to contest incumbents after this session plays out. So the results of this this session will, I think, have big electoral consequences. Another thing to mention in terms of the electoral consequences of this session, we have about a dozen new Democratic representatives in the Twin Cities suburbs who are on record now favoring a 20 cent a gallon gas increase. Those ads write themselves in a suburban
right.
district. And so there'll be electoral risks on the Democratic side as well.
Right. Well, one thing, you know, and about that gas tax, I mean, Tim Walz won pretty darn decisively. I mean, he won very handily, and he did campaign on a gas tax. Now, granted, when he was campaigning for governor in that election, again, which he won very easily, I mean, it was more than 10 points, he was talking about numbers. He wasn't talking about a specific amount or
right.
cent amount, but the estimates he was looking at were lower. They were 10%, about 10
right.
cents.
I think many people thought 10% would be the high end of possibility. Yeah.
And that was a surprise.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that something, I mean, do you think that that's sort of a negotiating chip that he's going to come
sure.
back around?
Well, you know, he's made that clear even in his State of the State address that he was willing to compromise. And so I think it's an opening bid. I really don't think that it will occur this year. Margaret Anderson Kelleher, who is the transportation commissioner, has said this is a four-year project to get all these revenues passed for transportation. So I think even she understands the difficulty of getting something done this year on the magnitude of 20 cents a gallon.
Right. But, you know, as they kind of struggle with all these issues, and also that medical that medical services tax
right.
is one that's very tricky. This is a 2% tax that's been in effect for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
It was set to be phased out. And now, so it wouldn't be a new tax, but
no.
In a way it would be a new tax. So that's what's so tricky about it.
Yeah, it would be a continuation of extending the current tax into the future. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's a tricky one too, but I just don't see how any of these, either party can risk a government shutdown.
Well, you know, we've done it before, and it could happen again. Mark Dayton was facing a Republican legislature, we had a government shutdown, the only one in the country. We are the only state that has divided state legislative
right.
control. Republicans control the state Senate, Democrats control the state House. Only state in America where that's the case, and in such a situation, a shutdown becomes much more likely.
Right. You know, there was an analysis, though, that came out that was basically from the governor's own staff saying that lower-income Minnesotans would be hit hardest by the governor's plan.
I know.
That didn't play very well and at all.
No, well, it's generally true at both the state and national level that if you want to raise a lot of revenues, the rich you can hit to a certain extent, but most you have to go where most of the taxpayers are, and that's what the Walz plan does. And most of the taxpayers are not rich, and that's why you get this result. It's an embarrassment for the governor, but it is a fact of fiscal life.
Right. But he seems to think that he's got sort of a mandate here. I mean, again, the time is sort of evaporating. And to a certain extent, you know, you can't do it all in the last day. It takes time to write these bills. It takes time to work them out. And I think that's what gets so difficult here.
Right. And I think the first real test will be whether they get an agreement on a tax bill. Because once you get an agreement on a tax bill, you know how much money you have to work with in the budget and can begin to work within those parameters. But if you can't get agreement on a tax number, you really can't do budgeting. And so that's going to be the acid test in the coming days.
All right. We're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, we'll have some closing thoughts with Professor Scheer. You're listening to News Talk 830 WCCO.
But things just get so crazy living.
8:47, we are back here, Esme Murphy, along with Professor Stephen Scheer, chatting about some of the difficulties at the state level when it comes to a political solution to our budget woes or getting a budget so we don't get into a government shutdown. One of the things you almost see when you kind of look at the Capitol these days is that the governor seems to be trying to push this together on the sheer force of his will and energy. I mean,
yeah.
he is sort of everywhere, which is, you know, in marked contrast to obviously Governor Dayton was having some very significant health problems in the final months, more so than we even realized. I think we were all so busy kind of covering the election that we really, you know, sort of didn't realize that he was in the hospital for a couple of months. Your thoughts about sort of the governor's leadership, and obviously this is somebody who I think is, I think he feels almost like if he just keeps churning out another news conference, he can get it done.
That's right. So I think he's doing two things. First of all, he is emphasizing, as you mentioned, a mandate from 2018 and really hanging his hat on that. And then second of all, he is essentially engaged in a permanent campaign. You know, he's out there working the state, paying a particular attention to greater Minnesota, where he thinks Democrats can really make a difference in developing a position as a long-term majority party in the state, since he's from Mankato and thinks he can appeal to greater Minnesota. So he's doing those two things, and with the hope that this will build momentum for his policy proposals. But most people don't think about political leaders in terms of, well, I like him, therefore everything he wants to do I
right.
approve of. You know, and I think he is very likable, but that doesn't mean people want to pay 20 cents a gallon for gas, more for gas. You know, that's an entirely different matter.
Right, right. And so I think that's going to be interesting to see what happens. But again, I just think that I just don't see how. I don't think either of them. I think it's a much more practical, and certainly in terms of the interpersonal dynamics, they certainly disagree just as much, but they at least seem to be a lot more civil. I don't know if that's
yes. Not, oh, I think that's true. First of all, Mark Dayton was really distant from state legislative Republicans, and there was I think, bad blood between them. Whereas Tim Walz, you know, has spent many years as a legislator, is used to understanding that you have to make agreements and come to compromises in order to get something through the legislature. So he knows that world and is comfortable in that world. And Paul Kozelka is not as contentious a figure as, say, Kurt Dowd was when he was Speaker of the House. So the person, and Melissa Hortman is obviously not a fire breather either. So the personalities are such that perhaps an accommodation is possible. But, Esme, you come back to the policy differences,
right.
They're huge.
Right, and that's just it. So it's you know, and it's there have been news conferences over there that have kind of started off by saying, well, Governor Walz is, we appreciate him reaching out and being open and all of this stuff, but it's the policy differences are still vast, and again, the timeline is you know, really different. Let me ask you, because you're somebody who looks at other states and how they do things, do other states have a better system, or do they run into this problem too?
Well, other states if you have divided government, you have
a problem. Yes,
you have problems. But if you have divided government, you have one party controlling the legislature and another party controlling the governorship, and that may involve a simpler negotiation than the three-way negotiation that we have going on now with a governor, a House, and the Senate all, you know, operating on their own agendas. But most states, or many states, I should say, may have one-party government, and then all the bargaining occurs within a common consensus, partisan consensus, and there's a lot less friction. So, you know, we're a divided state right now, and that's going to slow everything down.
Right, and that's something that we're going to have to obviously see and check out, and obviously there are only a few weeks left for them to kind of come to an agreement about this, as we've been saying. And then they all do have the built-in time between May 20th and July 1st in which they can have a special session.
Right. Although, now, they keep saying there won't be a special session. They think they can work this out. But so far, nothing's been worked out.
Right. Right. And so the time is it's very difficult to see how, at minimum, there's not going to be a special session. And I think the special session, I'm not sure that the public cares about that as much. It's the shutdown.
Oh,
and
yes.
If those parks aren't open July 1st after, you know,
yes.
Getting snow today in southern Minnesota, people are going to be upset, and rightfully so. I mean,
I think so. I think so.
Okay.
So we'll just have to wait and see. But right now, it's hard to see the way forward.
Absolutely. All right. Well, listen, Professor Stephen Scheer, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on this evening.
Happy to do it, Esme. Thank you.
Absolutely. Professor Stephen Scheer, again, always a pleasure to talk to him. Great insights. It will be interesting to see what happens at the Capitol. I'll be over there actually more than I normally am. I'll be over there on Monday of this week, and then the following week, which is, I believe, starts with Monday, May 6th, I'll be over there that entire week. So, and that's the way things have got to happen, because they can't just do it all in the last week. The deadline, May 20th, And so we'll see what happens, but it's going to be tough. And they are extremely far apart. As Professor Stephen Scheer said, it's just very difficult to see, as he said, and as he pointed out, how they can bridge this divide, because they are awfully, awfully far apart. Yes, they are more civil, but the gap is still there. That's all I can say. Listen, do want to invite you to tune in to WCCU-TV Sunday morning, 6 a.m., bright and early. Mike Gusnack and I will be there. We'll have the latest news. We'll have the latest on this horrible shooting in California. A gunman, a 19-year-old gunman, went in shooting in a synagogue the last day of Passover. One person is dead. There are others that are injured. CBS News will keep you updated throughout the evening. We'll have the latest tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. And also at 10:30 a.m. Then at 10:30 a.m., I'll have two special live guests. The first live guest will be Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, who obviously has been in the news a great deal. She is the freshman congresswoman. She won with an extraordinary majority. She won with well over 75% of the vote. I think 78%. It was one of the highest vote margins in the entire country. And she was elected to the 5th Congressional District. Obviously, it is an overwhelmingly Democratic district. But since her, becoming a member of Congress, she has gotten mired into a number of controversies about her past and present, mostly Twitter accounts. And the latest, actually, is sort of a Twitter war with none other than the president of the United States, President Trump, tweeting a number of weeks ago a video suggesting that Congresswoman Omar essentially was not taking the 9/11 attacks seriously enough. The genesis of that appears to be a comment that Congresswoman Omar made about the 9/11 attacks when she was talking to a Muslim group that was formed in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks to protect Muslims because there was so much backlash against Muslims. And I think that the statement was taken out of context. I think she could have chosen better words, or I think anytime you talk about that, especially for her to talk about it, I think you've got to be just very careful. But anyway, the president chose this little snippet. He puts on this, edits this video, which shows the worst moments of the horrible 9/11 attacks. And it's gotten millions of views. And since then, Congresswoman Omar has gotten many, 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 and we're talking hundreds of death threats. So it's obviously a very difficult situation. We're going to talk to her about that controversy. We're also going to talk to her about, she is the only member, a Democratic member of Congress, who is from Minnesota, I should say, that is calling for the president's impeachment. She also has been very active. She's on a number of key committees. She's been active there as well. And she was back in the district all this week. She does represent 700,000 people here in the state of Minnesota. So we want to hear about her policy ideas as well. So we'll talk to her about that. We'll also talk with Marsh Hallberg, who is a criminal defense attorney. And for many years, he was actually a prosecutor. He's a very good, very well-known, prominent criminal defense attorney, about the Mohammed Noor trial. Mohammed Noor, of course, is the Minneapolis police officer who was accused of murdering Justine Ruschek Damon in 2017. We'll get Marsh Hallberg's take on that. He is an expert criminal defense attorney. He's also sat in on much of the trial. So tune in, WCCO-TV, 6 a.m., 10:30 a.m. tomorrow.